Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Several decades ago, oral histories of ordinary men and women who lived in 8 Northern California counties were collected. Personal histories from Annie Bidwell's maid to the man who witnessed the last wild Indian emerge into a new world. In 1971, a small group of like-minded citizens and faculty from California State University, Chico, formed the Nonprofit Association for Northern California Historical Research to collect and preserve historical records. 4 members of this association edited Conversations with the Past, which is a collection of oral histories, and 2 of these people, Ron Womack and Josie Smith, are here today. Josie Smith is a board member and publications editor of ANCHOR, this association, and the Tehama County Genealogical and Historical Society. She's a member of many local historical societies and museums. She recently published Images of America, Tehama County. Josie Smith, welcome.
Thank you for having us again.
And then Ron Womack is the other editor who's my guest today, and he's written articles for Butte County Historical Society, Diggins. He participates in archaeological surveys in Tehama County, and he has been working in archaeology, field archaeology as well. Ron Womack, welcome.
Thank you for having me, and good to be here again.
You know, we're all so passionate about local history that it's hard for us to not want to talk about this. And specifically, I'd like to know how you researched this book. What did you turn to?
Well, what we found out that there was a collection of oral histories that ANCHOR collected when it started back in the 70s. It spent several years collecting oral histories. And almost 90 of these histories are at special collections. So I went there, made copies of everything that was there, thousands of pages, and then put them together, cataloged them, sent out a list to all the ANCHOR team.
Might remind people that this is this Association for Historical Research,
right.
ANCHOR.
And then we just picked what we were interested in. Like Ron is interested in the cattle drives. Nancy Leak, anything Bidwell.
Right.
David Brown, Rhodes, and myself, I just picked anything that was interesting. And that's how we put this book together. And then reading through the oral histories, we, you know, the history that we knew, we tried to complement with footnotes and stuff and explain terms that were used back then that aren't well known now. And this book just came together like that. So,
well, I was amused by the fact that the very first page you quote, I'm sure several people told you this, well, you need to talk to
right.
fill in the blank.
One of the things we wanted to do, we went to, there are 7 counties that have oral histories represented in this book. So we contacted museums and historical societies and asked for their help if they had anything to contribute. And a lot of them did. And so we would go visit. We would sit and talk to them. We made a lot of friends. We learned a lot. It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. So, and we acknowledged them in this book.
Well, I might mention you start with Ruby English, and that's a name that's not familiar to most of us. But she was the maid to Annie Bidwell.
Mm-hmm.
And as I read this, I forgot that she was only Annie Bidwell's maid from 1914 to 1918, which is a pretty long time. But her story is, she tells it in such a way that you just want to find, well, what happened next?
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much in here about Ruby's character.
Yes.
And that speaks louder than you know, for me, anything in here that was recorded. These things were recorded, and then they were transcribed. So we fortunately had the transcriptions to go from rather than going back to the recordings.
But one thing that was interesting that Nancy Leak, who put this one together, found out that she had never known before, Ruby English was African-American.
Oh, so she hadn't known that Ruby English was African-American.
So we, as what I said, as we put this together, we learned a lot of stuff by digging into the history. And so she learned that Ruby was African-American, and that sort of ties in with the dispute she had with the head cook that she describes.
I know it was painful for them at the time, but
right.
I really thought that was funny. So who was Ruby English? How did she become the maid to Annie Bidwell.
Well, as she said, at her beginning history, she says that a friend of hers asked if she'd like to work with Mrs. Bidwell for 2 weeks.
For two weeks.
Because two girls were going on vacation. And she said she would, and she met Mrs. Bidwell and introduced herself. And she, as she relates here, she says, I said to Mrs. Bidwell, my name is Ruby. And Mrs. Bidwell said, Ruby, that's a pretty name. She liked my name right away, and so she hired us. I was there about a week when Mrs. Bidwell said, you know, Ruby, I would like to have you stay with me. She said, I like the way you do your work. I like you, and I would like you to stay with me. And she said, well, you know, if it's okay with the girls, because she didn't want to, you know, step on anyone's
toes. Take away
toes.
Somebody else's
right.
job.
She didn't want to take Eva's
yeah.
job away.
Right.
Ruby was considerate of the people who were in the job before her.
Right. And, but Mrs. Bidwell was adamant. She's, as she says here, Mrs. Bidwell said, I will never be satisfied. I just want you to stay. I will write and tell Eva that you are going to stay, and I will give her extra pay. So Mrs. Bidwell is the one who insisted that Ruby be with her. And,
so it wasn't Ruby's
her.
Idea to
no.
replace this other employee
right.
of Mrs. Bidwell's. And in your book, Ruby says, I was with her, Mrs. Bidwell, about 7 months when one day she saw something I had written. And she said, Ruby, did you write this? And I said, yes, ma'am. And Josie, what did she reply?
And she said, you know, Mrs. Bidwell commented that she had a beautiful hand and said, I don't see why you couldn't do my writing. I don't see why I should keep Miss Chapman. She's a nurse. I don't need a trained nurse. And at that time, Miss Chapman did all Mrs. Bidwell's writing and dressing her hair and combing her. And then once again, Mrs. Bidwell, very adamant, I think I'll let you do Miss Chapman's work and I will get somebody else to do your work and you can be my secretary. So she progressed to being her secretary. And she said, well, if you want me to do that, that's all right. So Miss Chapman left. And
so Ruby gets promoted, really, to she is so trusted. She writes all the checks for Mrs. Bidwell and became her housekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
And traveling companion.
Right.
Oh, yes. She really liked a trip that they made. What was that trip that she and Mrs. Bidwell made to San Francisco?
Well, they went down to the
exposition
in 1915, and Ruby became part of the entourage from Chico and of course, had a wonderful time. They went to the fair. So she and I went to San Francisco, had an apartment there, and every day we would go to the fair. Mrs. Bidwell had one of her hands, her arms didn't work very well, which is why all the work with getting her hair done and these kinds of things.
She needed help with that.
And the writing. She needed help with that. So Ruby was a constant companion. And then social functions. The Bidwells were on par with many of the hobnobby, people in San Francisco. And so they had all these social functions.
And I was impressed with Annie Bidwell when I read what Ruby says. I went to church with her on Sundays. One Sunday night, we went into the Presbyterian Church. This is San Francisco
right.
now. And they gave her a standing ovation. That shows you the esteem in which they held Annie Bidwell in San Francisco.
Yes. And the train helped a lot with that because there was once we got the train through here, there was a lot of people that would come and go to San Francisco, and it just opened up Chico and the North State here to people who lived there and could afford to do all the traveling and whatnot.
And so many of them came to the Bidwell Mansion. I mean, Ruby really had a lot of work to do.
Mm-hmm.
They were there 3 or 4 weeks.
Host these people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, she... Ruby writes that when they came back home from San Francisco, she had company here. She entertained a lot. Mm-hmm. And then we learned that Ruby also plays the piano.
Yes.
She said she would have me come in and play for her guests. She would also have me sing for them. We had a wonderful time.
Yeah.
And then it comes across in Ruby's words that Annie Bidwell thought a lot of Ruby, and it says she would tell people how much she thought of me. She thought I was very faithful. And then here's...
And we get
I'm already laughing about this.
Yeah.
And so then, later, one of the women that was cooking there at the Bidwell Mansion had to go away. And so what happened?
Well, Mrs. Bidwell asked Ruby to write to a former employee, Florence Blake, who married a Mr. Proud. And they had worked for the Bidwells when the general had lived, as it says here. So they wrote and asked if Florence would come back up from San Francisco to be their cook. And the, as she relates
So at this point,
here,
Ruby doesn't know General Bidwell. She doesn't know Annie's husband.
General,
this was
She's
right.
only working there with Mrs. Bidwell.
Mrs. Bidwell.
The general had passed, I think, right around 1900, if I remember
yeah.
right.
Yeah. And the, so apparently Florence said, yes, she'd come up. But she, where Ruby was, she says here, I lived upstairs in the back. That was my apartment.
In the mansion, in Bidwell
yeah,
Mansion.
Yes. My apartment and sleeping porch, a bedroom, my bathroom, and a hallway. I lived there. But Florence wasn't happy. That I guess that she
well, Florence
wanted,
didn't come alone either
no,
from
she
San Francisco.
Her nine-year-old boy with her.
She
yeah.
brings her little boy with
and
her.
And she wanted that apartment. So, and I believe there was a little house in the back. It was it belonged to the coachman who used to live there. He got married, left. So Florence was
quarters.
Given Florence was given that house, which she didn't appreciate.
She wanted to live in the mansion.
She wanted to live in the mansion. So that's where they started having some tension there.
It's well, interesting that she married a man by the name of Proud.
Yeah.
yeah
she was
she
proud.
Is. She's also quite jealous that
yeah.
comes across.
Well, as Ruby states, she says, so from the very start, she didn't like me. She thought that because she had been here when the general lived, Mrs. Bidwell should show her preference. I guess she thought that. Florence didn't like me. I did all the buying. Every morning I would go to Florence and see what she needed for the day. Then the coachman would take me in the carriage uptown and I bought all the groceries. I was supposed to go back there and get her list of what she needed. She didn't like that. She went to Mrs. Bidwell and said, I don't see why I have to tell Ruby what I want for my cooking. I could just as well do my own buying rather than tell Ruby every day and have her buy for the kitchen. Mrs. Bidwell said, Florence, I will tell you why. It's because Ruby keeps books on everything in the house. And because she was, Ruby was the bookkeeper. So, and
so
then
that
it
would be
just
double
progressed.
Work for her if Florence does her own buying.
And especially
Another
if Florence didn't
books.
Like her.
Yeah.
You know.
Yes.
So.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. We're going to take a break, then I'll be back with my guests, two of the editors of Conversations with the Past, a collection of oral histories from eight Northern California counties. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with Josie Smith and Ron Womack from the Association for Northern California Historical Research, and they're editors of a collection of vibrant voices from Butte, Colusa, Glenn, Modoc, Plumas, Shasta, and Tehama counties. The publisher is Anchor, the Association for Northern California Historical Research, and two of the editors are with me, and they're quite familiar with these local stories, and right now, we were talking about the maid that was working for Annie Bidwell in her later years. So she has this friction with this new cook that's been mm-hmm. hired.
And to continue, Mrs. Bidwell tells Florence, look, you know, there's no need to keep separate books because Ruby has to do it and then you'll keep your books. It just gets confusing. So Ruby will take care of everything. And as Mrs. Bidwell says, there's no sense in having two sets of bookkeeping going on. You can just as well tell Ruby what you need. In fact, you will have to do it once again.
Uh-oh.
Mrs. Bidwell is laying down the law. Well, that made Florence mad. everything rubbed her the wrong way. Mrs. Bidwell would just tell her right out and out. And so...
But Florence then comes up with another way of getting back
annoying.
At annoying Ruby.
Right.
And what does she do then?
Apparently, Ruby wanted some cream from a pitcher of milk.
Yeah.
And Florence said, and there was a pitcher there.
Because Mrs. Bidwell had four or five Jersey cows.
You're right.
And so they had plenty of milk.
They didn't have to buy milk. And but Florence said, nope, there's not enough. I can't give you any kind of cream. So Ruby didn't say anything. And two or three days went by. And then she went for breakfast and there was no cream. And so she told Mrs. Bidwell that Florence won't give me any cream for my breakfast. And Mrs. Bidwell says, quote, oh, the idea. We have so much of it from the Jersey cow, she said. She went down and said, now, Florence, I want to tell you something. Anytime there isn't enough cream or enough of anything in this house for Ruby to have what she wants to eat, I will do without because Ruby works all day and I am not doing anything, so I don't need as much as Ruby. I want her to have as much as she wants. And she turned and went out. So then Florence had to give her cream. But that still didn't make her happy because Florence was well known for her cakes that she made, the best, as Ruby says, the best wonderful cakes, but she wouldn't give Ruby any.
Of course, then
she goes
Mrs. Bidwell has to
step in again. Yeah. She said, I told Mrs. Bidwell, now Florence won't give me any cake. Why, Ruby, Mrs. Bidwell says, what is the matter with you and Florence? I said, Florence just doesn't like me. So Mrs. Bidwell said, Florence, I want Ruby to have cake. Anything out there Ruby wants, I want you to give Ruby cake and cream. Why don't you want her to have it? All right, Mrs. Bidwell, I will make some cakes for Ruby. And believe it or not, you wouldn't think that anybody that made the fine cakes that she made could make the kind of cake that she made for me. It was worse than cornbread.
Oh, dear.
She made those two cakes and said I could have them. Of course I wouldn't touch them. Anyway, we got along like that.
So how did they come to any resolution to this controversy?
Nope. As I recall, Florence kept up just needling her and just creating more tension. And finally, I think Mrs. Bidwell had enough. And she
gave Florence an ultimatum.
So
you shape up or ship out.
And she shipped her out. She ultimately shipped her out. So,
and she says, she tells Florence, why you can't get along with her, I can't understand. Evidently, you can't. So you'll have to go back to San Francisco. So Florence is very well. And so she tells Ruby, well, you just make out a check for Florence because mm-hmm. she's going back to San Francisco.
Right.
And Ruby says, all right. I never let on that I had heard because Ruby went up to the door to hear this conversation of Mrs. Bidwell firing Florence. And so she already knew that, Florence is going to be leaving.
And then Ruby started cooking until she told Mrs. Bidwell about her aunt, who was a good cook who lived in Oakland. And her aunt came up and started what became the cook for Mrs. Bidwell.
Well, all these things are going fine. She talks about Mrs. Bidwell. Mrs. Bidwell, people probably know she's a tiny little thing, but she stands upright. And it comes a point where Mrs. Bidwell starts having a headache. And she went regularly to a prayer meeting on Wednesday evenings. And so Ruby goes up and dresses Mrs. Bidwell and got her ready to go to her prayer meeting. But what did Mrs. Bidwell say?
She said, I just... don't know. My head hurts so bad. I said, I don't think you better go. And she said, Mrs. Bidwell, well, all right, I will stay home. We took her clothes off and she kept complaining about her head. So I said, I'd better call a doctor.
So she'd been complaining about this headache so bad that she didn't want to go to her prayer meeting. And so the doctor came and it happened to be a woman doctor. And she...
who happened to be a cousin of John Bidwell, Dr. Gatchell.
And gave her some medicine, and the doctor didn't think it was anything too serious. I mean, a headache could be so many different things,
mm-hmm.
It's kind of the equivalent, take two aspirin and call me in the morning. And she went away, but the next morning, was it better?
No. It was really bad. And then they called Dr. Enloe, and he came in with two or three other doctors. They were consulted, but...
And so they had some trained nurses. Everything she wanted done, we would do it. And this is Ruby talking now. And the nurse says, "Why, Mrs. Bidwell, we're here to take care of you. Why do you always want Ruby to do everything?" And then she replied, Mrs. Bidwell says, "Ruby knows how I want it done." So the nurses stood there, and I, Ruby, took care of Mrs. Mm-hmm. Bidwell.
Mm-hmm. And then she said, Ruby goes on to say, "You know what she said?" Mrs. Bidwell says, "Ruby, my head feels like it's full of piles of grass." Now, whatever that meant, my head feels like full piles of grass. No one really understood what that meant.
Yeah.
So Ruby's puzzled that Mrs. Bidwell is saying, describing her headache as feeling like her head is full of piles of grass. And then...
10 days later, she passed. And Ruby was next to her when she passed.
She says here, "To make a long story short, she died of old age. I don't think anybody ever knew what she actually died of."
And then she quotes Mrs. Bidwell about the piles of grass is what her mm-hmm. headache felt
yeah.
like.
Mm-hmm.
And so she says, other than that, she was apparently well. She had dinner that evening. I went up and dressed her. And then Ruby, as you said, was beside her when Mrs. Bidwell died. And Ruby says, "The nurses were also there. I was right at the side of her bed when she breathed her last breath. She didn't say anything except, 'My head feels like it's full of piles of grass.'" And she'd say that over and over. And Ruby says, "What kind of pain that was, I don't know." And so then the family invites Ruby to fix Mrs. Bidwell's hair. Said, "You always fixed her hair." And she wore her hair in those little rag curls all over. So that's how Ruby prepared Mrs. Bidwell's hair. And she thought that Mrs. Bidwell was a beautiful woman. Mm-hmm. And this is such a touching story about Mrs. Bidwell's maid, confidant even,
mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That took care of her. My guests are Ron Womack and Josie Smith, and they collaborated on Conversations with the Past, Vibrant Voices from Butte, Colusa, Glenn, Modoc, Plumas, Shasta, and Tehama counties. Now, on your cover, you have a picture of a smiling Ishi. And I love seeing that picture because the pictures I usually see of him, he is looking depressed and glum and not well. And here's a smiling Ishi on the cover of your book. So now that I've mentioned Ishi, who the heck was Ishi for anybody in the Northern California who might not know who? What about, you have a story about how Ishi got his name.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
So why don't you tell us, how did Ishi get his name? Because I've heard different things.
Well, there was, Ishi couldn't speak any English, but maybe a couple of words of Spanish at the most. And so there wasn't
Because they tried both of those.
Right, and there wasn't any, you know, they needed to call him something. And so Ed Kessler here was, he was 20.
So these you're quoting Ed Kessler now.
Right, Ed Kessler, Adler. He's writing here, "The story about Ishi getting his name, then there's a little controversy there. That name was given him by the sheriff of Butte County, John B. Weber. The question was, he was asked many times, especially after the press found out about Ishi, what is he? Who is he? Where did you get him? Who found him? What was he doing? All those questions. And finally, one day there, they had the sheriff cornered. All gang of ladies and men with pad and pencil. The sheriff says, I'm going to change his name. He's going to cut off what and who, and it's just going to be, is he, Ishi. That's going to be his name.
Mm.
Put is and he together, and it becomes Ishi. That'll be good enough for him. The sheriff named him right there.
Now, so this is according to Ed Kessler,
right.
Ed Kessler, that the sheriff is the one who named mm-hmm. him. And, you know, as I'm reading this story, they're referring to this human being as it and saying, what is he, as well as who is he? And that kind of hurts.
It kind of, well, it had been since the surveying party of 1908, that was 3 years earlier, that anyone had seen a Native American that lived in the bush. And that was very brief, and they never saw them again. And that was up in Deer Creek Canyon. So 3 years later, here comes another, an Indian, and couldn't talk to him, didn't understand who he was or anything, except he looked like he was hungry, and he had a good appetite. And so this is the dilemma for the sheriff through all this was, okay, they gave him a padded cell, more to protect him from the onlookers and curious to than anything else to keep him safe, but he couldn't live there forever. And
well, one story, speaking of his name, one story I had heard that that Ishi was a word that he understood, that it meant man.
That was, I think, the first time I read that was in Theodora Kroeber's book, Ishi in Two Worlds. And until I read this article, that's the only reference I ever had to how he was named.
Well, they also, Ad also goes on to say that he's read the book, too. And the way she describes how Ishi was captured by them is totally false, because he was there when Ishi was discovered by the little boy.
The guy that
it was a little boy who
source,
liked to tag along.
The story. Mm-hmm.
Right. And they
but
didn't.
But that's amazing that he was still alive. And
yes.
Somebody was able to interview this guy who was on the scene when Ishi was discovered.
Yeah, 1979, I think he was mm-hmm. interviewed. It was.
Yeah.
They found
Richard Smith interviewed
right.
him in February of 1979.
Right, and this happened in 1911, so.
Well, how did Ishi just suddenly appear? Because they knew nothing about him.
Well, it says here, we had a boy, perhaps 9 or 10 years old, and this boy was alone all day. So instead of him staying in the barns around the corrals, he would come down here where we were just spend the afternoon with us. He liked to be around the cattle. His name was Floyd Hefner, and he was a good boy. They loved having him around. And so it says here, that particular evening, around 7:30, maybe a quarter to 8, he took a halter, throwed it over his shoulder, and went out to go in the big corral to get the horses. When we got there in the morning, we turned these horses up loose in the big corral where there was water and hay, and that evening we'd take a halter and go get them. A halter is something you lead a horse with. So that particular evening, Floyd spotted a man sitting between the barn and the high fence of the corral. It scared him.
Because he's just 9 or 10 years mm-hmm. old,
right.
And here's this strange being.
In the evening.
In the evening.
It's getting dark, yeah.
And naturally he'd be scared. And what did he say?
I heard him holler, Ed, there's a man here.
So he's hollering to the guy that is the source of this information, that's mm-hmm, telling
right.
this story,
mm-hmm.
Adolph Kessler. And so he says, there's a man here.
What'd you say, Floyd? There's a man here. Well, I knew that there shouldn't be a man there at this time of night, so I told him, I'll be right over. I had to go over 2 or 3 of these little corrals, sheep corrals. I picked up a stick about that long, placing his hand about 20 inches apart, that we called a hog gambrel. You put it in a hog's legs to raise him up for slaughter. And he says to him, but boy, where is he? He says, right in there. He pointed to a man sitting on his haunches with his back against the barn. And perhaps about 4 feet from him, I crawled over this fence and I saw this man. This was a board fence made of 2x8s, about 8 feet tall, where the cattle come a-running.
So this young boy, let me just remind people that this is Ron Womack, one of the editors of this book, Conversations with the Past, and he is quoting a guy named Adolph Kessler, Ad for short, and he has just been informed by this young boy that there's this strange man on the property. And so Ad says, I cleared the fence, got down, pushed this fellow over. That seemed a rather odd thing to me. And he said, he wasn't very rough. I just shoved him over. And then he raised up this stick because he said, I thought if he was going to fight, I'd fight him. But instead of that, he didn't show any fight at all. He muttered a little, just like that. And that's all he ever said. So Ad Kessler could tell that this poor guy was scared.
Mm-hmm. He goes on saying, well, of course he would be. You've got this big guy over you with a stick threatening you. And so Ad calmed down, and he said he tried to talk to him, and it's pretty cute what he says here.
Yeah.
At that time, I could talk pretty well Spanish, both languages, vulgar and profane. And I talked to him, and he just gazed around as though I wasn't there. And I tapped him on the shoulder to make him look toward me, and he'd look up and then just draw his head around.
So it's interesting. We don't know till later. We have no idea. He has no idea how old this person is. But he's guessing. He said, it looks like he's an old man. He said he was at least 60 or 65 years old. He wasn't very tall. He was 5'6". And he said he wouldn't weigh over 125 or 130 pounds. And then he describes how this guy is dressed. And this is a photograph that is often mm-hmm. shown of Ishii, which you reproduce in your book, a picture of him shortly after he was captured. And here's this guy with this blank expression on his face, so unlike the smile on the cover of your book of Ishii with this big smile on his face, which I was happy
well,
to see.
Well, to give context to the smiling picture, these photos are in the Tehama County Museum in the little town of Tehama, and these are still shots from film, and he was giving a demonstration down in Berkeley of a spear or atlatl throwing or something like that.
Yeah.
So now where this film is, no one knows. But they do have still photos, and that's where he's sitting, and he's smiling, and that's such a lovely picture.
It's so unlike the photograph that you have reproduced in Mr. Kessler's story of an Ishii that's just staring blankly, and his clothes are ragged. Of course, he has no shoes on.
Mm-hmm.
So what was he wearing?
They said like a sheep herder's jacket or a Chinese shirt, and he explains that the Chinamen, they wore them around in the mines and in the orchards and on the gangs preparing railroad. You slip them over your head. They didn't come clear down like they do now. They came pretty well down to the knees.
So here's this Ishii in this shirt, kind of looks like just a dress. And then I didn't remember this. The lobe of each ear was pierced and buckskin string put in his ears. So Ishii had pierced ears, and there was a knot back there and in the front to keep it from falling out. And here's something else I haven't seen this in photographs. What did he have in his nose?
He had a little stick in his nose, a very small little stick.
Like a match.
Like a match,
mm-hmm.
right.
Like a match.
And you say that wood was about as thick as an ordinary match is today, or a trifle bit thicker. And you had to look pretty close to see it. So I guess that's why if it is in the photograph, which it must be, it's hard to see. And then he's got short hair in this picture. And I enjoyed the description of how Ishii shortened his hair. I mean, men in those days wanted, you got scissors or knives.
Mm-hmm.
But how did Ishii shorten his hair?
Well, you know, this would make me living out in the middle of dry grass in the summer cringe. But he would pick some dry grass and set fire to it. He didn't have the dexterity at the time to strike a match without breaking it. So Ad struck the match for him, and he would light the grass, and then he would brush it over his hair and singe his hair back, which was a rather novel. I'd never heard of this before.
It's scary to think of putting fire to your head.
Right, to keep your hair short.
Keep your hair short.
And I remember in some of the other books I've read, they talked about his hair being burned. And that was also something they did when they were in mourning. Mm-hmm. So there was some question about when they found him, whether he had been in mourning from his group. And here we have another insight into that, in that he sat there and singed his hair for Ad to show him how he did it. And that's how he kept his hair short.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. After a break, I'll be back with my guests, Ron Womack and Josie Smith, from the Association of Northern California Historical Research. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guests today are Josie Smith and Ron Womack, who are editors of Conversations with the Past, Vibrant Voices from Butte, Colusa, Glenn, Modoc, Plumas, Shasta, and Tehama Counties. So another thing that I was amused that, well, he talks about the fact that his Ishi's feet were so tough, he didn't need shoes. He probably hadn't worn shoes in years, if ever.
And this was sometime after the time when, 30 years earlier, that school children often went to school barefoot. Shoes were kept for Sunday go to meeting or for going into town. And I like the description he has of how thick the soles of his feet were. The soles of his feet were like shoe leather. And this helped them climb over the top of lava
and not feel
walk
any
through
pain
stickers yet. And not feel any pain.
Well, and I had seen the picture of Ishi very obligingly dressing in European clothes with a straw hat.
Right.
But politely carrying the shoes that he'd been given, yep. Not wearing them on his feet. And I didn't read it in here, but I had read that he said he likes to feel the earth under his feet.
Right.
That connection to the earth.
Well, the only reason, in my experience, that we really need shoes is because of tender feet like me that can't even walk in green grass, or because we have sidewalks and hard surfaces and we need the shoes to support our feet.
And there was a pocket on Ishi's shirt, and of course, Ad is curious. Well, what's he got in his pocket? And what was in his pocket?
It was some dried meat. They don't know if it was from a bird or chipmunk or squirrel, but it was dried up hard, and that's what he had in his pocket, a little piece of dried meat, about an inch and a half long.
And then he called to a partner to come, and when he came, this partner was named Bill. This is now our narrator, Ad. I yelled to the partner, Bill, would you mind sitting down here and entertaining this guy while I call the sheriff? And what did Bill say?
He says, I don't want nothing to do with that guy. You can have him.
And, of course, he didn't know
what to do with him either.
Yeah. Right. And so he called somebody else. And
it was Diamond Dick.
So he asked Dick if he would stay there with this fellow while he called the sheriff. So he did. He came over and he smoked a couple of cigarettes.
And that's how they broke the ice.
Yeah.
With the tobacco.
Yeah.
So this, your narrator, when he called the sheriff, he'd actually worked for the sheriff one time when he was a kid. And you're mentioning that this smoking a cigarette was kind of the icebreaker. And we wouldn't think of, here's this stranger, we don't even know what he is or who he is. And yet he seems fascinated by Ad smoking a cigarette. So how did he didn't just pull out a packet.
No, this was the days of Bull Durham. And so
and you rolled your own.
You rolled your own.
And so Ishi watches him roll a cigarette,
right.
And
he indicated that he'd, by hand motions, that he'd like to have one. And so Ad hands him the paper and the tobacco, and he managed to do what I tried to do that, too, back when I was in my 20s. And I did the same thing. I put way too much tobacco in there, and it didn't stay together very well.
So that's what Ishi does.
And that's what happened with him. So at long last, Ad rolled him one and handed it to him and struck a match and lighted it for him, which gave Ishi a tremendous pleasure.
Well, and what did Ishi do with the tobacco when Ad handed him the tobacco?
Oh, he put it in his pocket.
And Ishi puts it in his own pocket.
He wasn't going to waste that. Yeah.
And so Ishi's trying to roll his own cigarette. But now comes the problem of lighting the cigarette. And he wanted, of course, a match. And what was the problem that Ishi had with the match?
Well, first he didn't know how to strike it.
Yeah, well, and I'm not familiar with this, that matches came in blocks, about 50 in a block, and a little square block, probably an inch and a quarter in diameter. And so Ishi had to deal with that. And he'd break off a match, and he'd scratch it on some rock or
and
something.
And they tried to show him how to strike it against a rock, but he kept breaking. He would break his matches, he'd try, but
Those were called sulfur matches.
Mentions these sulfur matches.
He'd scratch it some, and he'd scratch it, and it'd come on a rock, and it would break. The match would break in half. So they were none of this paper matchbook with a strip on it. They were doing it the old-fashioned way against a rock, and so he says here, I gave him a match, and he looked at it and kept looking at it. So I took it. And I turned it over opposite the way he had it. In other words, he was looking at the match, and he was looking at the at the end that had no sulfur on it. I showed him how to strike it. Well, he held it in the middle, and he broke it. He looked at me, and he looked, and he tried to use the other end to start a fire. So I gave him another match, and he broke that. That happened three different times. So he says here, I took a match, I scratched it on a rock, and got fire. And I got another big smile from him.
That was nice, too, because most of the time he just has this flat affect. But when Ad, our narrator, strikes a match for him, he gets a smile from Ishi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, of course, he holds it up real quick for Ishi to light his cigarette, which Ad says it's about as big as a cigar, has so much tobacco in it.
But then Ishi also got a big whiff of that sulfur smoke, which Ad admits he shouldn't have, held the match to him that fast, but he still smiled. He straightened up and smiled. He said he wasn't holding any animosity, and he smoked that cigarette. He smoked that cigarette down to where it just burned his skin a little, and then he dropped it.
My guests are Josie Smith and Ron Womack, who are editors of Conversations with the Past, which is a publication of the Association for Northern California Historical Research. And this, you mentioned earlier, Ron, that so they don't know what to do with this guy.
Right.
And so the sheriff locks him up.
Yeah, put him in a padded cell. They weren't sure. They realized he was somewhat docile, but they weren't sure how he would do in captivity. And they switched from what they thought he might harm somebody, flipped immediately into keeping others from harming him. So they had it. Today we would call that protective custody.
Yeah, and they didn't know how is he going to react to these handcuffs we're putting on him. And then there's the matter of what are they going to feed him? He must be hungry. So he was offered a biscuit and
beans.
He didn't go for that. Yep. He didn't go for the biscuit, but
right.
The beans.
No, but the beans he liked.
He did
he
like
loved the beans.
They even named the cafe in here that he went down.
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah, there was a cafe called the Tin Can on Montgomery Street. And they served beans there. And so they got him a bowl of beans. And here comes this bowl of beans and this white napkin on top. And and Ishi doesn't always know what to do with some things like a napkin. So he just lets it fall to the floor if he doesn't know what to do with it. But he did have a spoon in it. And he took the napkin and set it down and just let it fall out of his hands. But apparently the beans smell so good, he smiled again about that. And Ad, our narrator, motions like dipping the fingers to put them in the mouth to eat the beans. So he liked that. And then they don't want to feed him too much. And so they moderated. He probably would have liked some more beans. Now also, Ishi indicated that he was thirsty. And how did they give him some water? If you remember, the water wasn't necessarily that drinkable that they had for processing the butcher aspect of the business. And so he had to go up and get some water for Ishi. And so they feed Ishi, they give him water. And then they still haven't communicated with him. So there's this professor down in Berkeley who says, hey, I'd like a shot. Maybe I can communicate with him. I know a bunch of Indian languages.
That was Professor Waterman.
So he comes up, and what success did he have?
Not much.
No, he didn't.
Not much.
So they don't have any success still communicating. They don't know what language Ishi speaks. And I was interested in how they figured out. So they're wondering, well, how did Ishi get here? How did he end up in this corral?
This is something that never hit the newspapers.
Yeah.
And something that was not in Theodore Kroeber's book, Ishin Two Worlds. And it's fascinating. One of the things about being in the cattle business where you're having to run down strays and things is you learn how to track. And so what...
And you get help from smart dogs.
Oh, well, yes.
Right.
And so they backtracked Ishi from the slaughterhouse.
Yeah, it was.
Ishi has big feet.
Yeah, Ad and his friend Bill Prouder and four of the slaughterhouse dogs.
So the dogs catch on real quick.
Went around the corral and we found where Ishi climbed over the fence. The stock, when they come in from the range, they go up alongside the fence and they'd make a little trail. There was dust there. Here was Ishi's tracks. He climbed over the top that had two barbed wires. He went over the top of that and he dropped down inside. That was a 7-foot wire fence, a heavy cattle wire fence. That is how he got inside the corral. So they backtracked him. And he's going on here. It says Ishi's big tracks would show up. It was easy to follow because it looked like a big bear. It wasn't a very short time before the dogs knew what we were after, so they got streaking one behind the other. And they lost the track in the chaparral, but the dogs didn't. And then they'd come out on the other side, up near the Feather River Tannery, and they kept on going.
So they figured out how Ishi had gotten to the slaughterhouse by backtracking with the help of the dogs. And Ishi, you mentioned in the photograph that was taken in Berkeley, the photograph that's on the cover of your book. So Ishi is studied, taken to Berkeley so they can study him.
Fed very well.
And fed very well.
And they gave him a job. And his job essentially was being, I guess you would say, somewhat of a custodian. He was also there to educate people. And they did some filming of him, and he gained his weight, and he gained his smile, too.
Yes, and that's the lovely photograph we see on your cover. Now, just below the photograph of Ishi, there's a photograph of somebody whose image is very, very familiar to those of us all over the United States. And this is John F. Kennedy. And the photograph is one of Kennedy feeding a deer. So in preparation for, well, where did Kennedy come? Why did he come to California?
Back in 1963, September 1963, I think the Secretary of the Interior was Udall from Utah, and he wanted to show Kennedy the natural resources that could be, you know, utilized in the western states. So for five days, they embarked on what they called the Conservation Tour of Western States. It was an 11-state tour of Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Minnesota, North Dakota, Wyoming, Montana, Washington, Utah, Oregon, and California, and Nevada. And Kennedy came to Northern California. A Whiskeytown Dam had just been constructed, so they were going to dedicate it.
Right.
The day before, they flew him into Lassen Park. That's where he's going to stay for the night before going to Whiskeytown. And that's where the picture of the deer was that evening when he had come in. He's in his pajamas, and two deer came in, and he wanted to feed them. And that's where the White House photographer took this iconic photo of Kennedy feeding the deer that evening.
Well, I was amused by the fact that when Kennedy's coming— they want to clean up the park. And so in preparation for Kennedy's arrival, they were told to rake and clean an area that had pine cones and needles and other debris. And so then the powers that be come out and looked at this cleaned up area and said, hey, wait a minute, that area is too clean. It doesn't look natural enough. So they were ordered to put everything back, the pine needles and the cones and the debris.
Which took several truckloads to do. This originally they were trying to determine where can the helicopters land. And first they were going to land, they were thinking Eskimo Hill, which is north of the park. But because of traffic considerations, they thought, well, why don't we have the helicopters land in the parking lot by devastated area in Lassen Park? And that's the area they cleaned up. And this story was told to me by Larry Moulton, the son of Hobart Moulton, who was in charge of maintenance at Lassen and was in charge of cleaning up the area when this happened.
So I asked to repeat when this was, September 1963, because this Whiskeytown dedication was Kennedy's last official act before heading to Dallas 2 months later.
Yeah.
You know, there are so many stories in this book. I mean, we have the words of John Bidwell and his encounter with some Indians, and people will be so, I think, captured by hearing these stories in the words of the people who were there.
Right.
And there's a story of this young teenage pilot that people don't, what? A teenage
that
pilot?
Is from Chico.
From Chico. Mm-hmm. Right. So there's so many stories in this book. Where can people get a copy of this so they can read it for themselves?
Well, there's Made in Chico has it, and so does the bookstore and ABC Books and Discount Books in Oroville. They also have this book, and it's been very popular. And we love working on it. And, you know, one of the things that is so sweet about being on this committee, this team, is that the learning curve is always steep and it's always fascinating.
Let me remind listeners, the title of your book is Conversations with the Past, Vibrant Voices from Butte, Colusa, Glenn, Modoc, Plumas, Shasta, and Tehama Counties. And the publisher is the Association for Northern California Historical Research. And my guests have been two members of this association who edited this book, Conversations with the Past, Ron Womack and Josie Smith. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.